So some of you know me and some of you don't know me. So let me sort of do a bit of an introduction. And in the process of doing the introduction, give you some sort of an outline of where I'm thinking of going in this class. So I'm trying to figure out, okay. That's good. Kay's taking up the whole screen. That's fine to look at her. So. Okay, so I'm a professor of philosophy and religion, and I teach at Portland State University, which is in Oregon. So ordinarily, the way that I do classes, in fact, the way I even do Dharma classes, of which I've done, I don't several hundred, I don't know how many, is that usually I sort of start from one point and I go to another point. Sort of A, B, C, D, E, F, G. But I didn't think I wanted to do that this time. And in fact, I don't think teaching about Tantra really lends itself to that kind of an approach. So I thought that the approach that I would take is different in several ways. One way is that rather than talking about sort of this is how Tantra works, these are the theories of how Tantra works, and this is what systematically you would learn if you were going to get this information from the teacher, I thought I would talk a bit more from my own experience, which is now almost 35 years of doing Yamantaka, which is the highest yoga Tantra practice. And on that basis, talk about Tantra in general. And toward the end of this talk, we will, in fact, be looking at the white Tara sadhana, which is one of the lower tantras, something that you can look at without an initiation. So we can do that without getting into trouble of breaking any kinds of vows. But the other thing is that sort of the way that I want to talk, as I said, is not strictly linear from A, B, C, D, E, F, G. And as I thought about it, I thought that the best way to describe the approach that I want to take is that it's like painting a picture, that I begin with a several brush stroke. Well, actually, let me put it this way. Anil, why don't you put up the picture of white Tara? Nope, that's the wrong one. Nope, there you go. There's white Tara. So this is where we're going to end. with white Tara. Excuse me. This is a tanka that my wife did about 20 years ago of white Tara. And when you're doing iconic painting, which tankas are, you're producing a visual Dharma teaching. And since you're producing a visual Dharma teaching, there are certain forms that the teaching does actually need to take. So why don't you now, Anil, put up the picture of the drawing and the grid lines. So when you're doing a tanka, you start out with grid lines, which is to say with an iconic form. So you'll see that in just a minute. Here we go, this one right here, yeah. So if you look closely at this, this is a painting that Kate's working on right now. You can see the drawing. This is a form of Tara called Parnashawari, who protects from fires and plagues and other natural disasters, very suitable for our times, which is the reason Kay's doing it. But if you look closely, you can see lines that are running through here, which are grid lines. So she has to lay out the entire grid before doing the painting. And the grid lines are very specific. And at a certain point where lines intersect, or something along that, you'll put a piece of a form, like an eye. And you can see the third eye on Parnashawari is right down the center of her face, and there's a grid line there. So that's how you start out. And that's how I'm going to start out. I'm going to start out by laying out sort of a structure of what I'm going to be doing and some of the fundamental ideas that I have about Tantra. And then the next thing I'll do is I'll start filling that in. So why don't you go now to Parnashawari 2, Anil? And just as with a painting, you start filling in the color, which we'll see in just a moment, which would be the one on the top that we're looking at now, Anil. Yeah, that one. Whoops, that's wrong. We've gone too far. The other one. There we go. So then you start filling in the colors. And as you can see in this painting, only some of the colors are there. I mean, the outline has been filled in some more, and there's some green and there's some red and that sort of thing. But there are a whole lot of other colors in the painting. So she started with certain kinds of similarities of color. I mean, that's done for some economical bases, because she puts out the green paint, so she's going to go ahead and use it. And then where that leads is to the next image, please, of Parashiwari. Anil, next image, what's happening? There we go. Then finally, all the other colors come in, and you start seeing you see where the painting is going to be. But there's something else here that I want to point out to you. You see these birds on the right-hand side and also in the upper left-hand corner? They're recognizable because in a certain way, they're empty space. They're recognizable as birds, more or less, by the way the space has been filled in around them without actually painting the space of the bird. And in the practice and study of Tantra, and also in the way I'll be talking about Tantra, sometimes the best way to talk about things is to talk around things, to fill in the space around them of the thing that you want to talk about or the thing that you want understood, without actually trying to touch it itself. Okay. And there are good reasons for that. In the early days of Buddhism, there were no images of the Buddha. How could you have images of the Buddha? It was reasoned, because the Buddha is not exactly a person in the ordinary way that you see a person. So the way the Buddha would be represented or symbolized in a way was the empty space, excuse me, the empty space that was left when you looked at his sandals or at a cushion. So you knew the Buddha was there, even though you couldn't see him, because of what was sort of painted around him. Okay. And this is actually, in my experience, a very important way of understanding much of the Dharma, both from the point of view of Sutra and from the point of view of Tantra. Because there are some things that are difficult to talk about and have understood clearly for people who've not really experienced those things. So it's kind of ironic. You want to talk about something, and if you talk about it directly, you could be creating as much confusion as anything else. So you talk around it, and then people in their own experience can sort of find it in some way. Okay, so you can put the painting down now and come back to me. Although I know I'm not as attractive as Parashiwari, but nevertheless, this is the way we'll do it for the moment. Okay, so this is the approach I'll take, like doing a painting. And what we'll do here is first draw in the grid lines, you know, which is in this case, the stuff that's been particularly important to me over the years of my practice and in thinking about things. And I have to back up for just a moment to say that before becoming a scholar of Buddhism, I was a psychologist. I worked as a counseling psychologist for quite a number of years. But my heart was always in teaching religion and in the practice of Dharma. But my early experience stuck with me. So I've always kind of had this approach toward my own understanding of the Dharma as somewhat of a psychologist and somewhat of a scholar of religion. And so that's going to make an appearance today and over the next couple of days, if we go that far, as I talk about the psychology of Tantra. And I'm just going to assume people know what I mean when I talk about Tantra without going into it. I mean, it's possible that we can go down all kinds of sidelines and kind of get lost if we do that. So the first part of the grid is what's called the nine mixings. So Thubten Norbu Ling, as part of FPMT, is in the Gelupa, or in the Geluk tradition. Gelupa is a person who's in the Geluk tradition. And that really traces itself to Tsongkhapa, as I'm sure you all know. Tsongkhapa was a master of sutra and tantra. And in the teachings that he gave, in the advanced teachings that he gave on the Guhyu Samaja Tantra, he talked about something called the nine mixings. Now, the nine mixings as such is not really something that we could talk about in this particular class. It's very advanced. And I have to be honest to say that I barely understand what the nine mixings are about from the point of view of practice. But from the point of view of talking about an overview of Tantra or theory of Tantric practice, they provide a useful framework. And so here's what that framework is. And I'm just going to lay out the framework and then move on to something else. So the nine mixings are, in a sense, in three categories. Nine categories of consciousness. The first category is what we all experience in the 24 hours and what we're familiar with, which is waking consciousness, dreaming consciousness, and dreamless sleep. So we're all familiar with that. We may not always be aware of it's happening in all of those, but we are familiar with the fact that we dream. Most of us at one time or another remember our dreams, and we all dream whether we remember them or not. And we all experience dreamless sleep, although we don't tend to know we're experiencing it, because from the Western point of view, when we're in dreamless sleep, we're unconscious. However, from the Buddhist point of view, when we're in dreamless sleep, we're actually conscious. We're just not conscious of anything. Or we could say we're conscious of nothing. Now, I'm going to go into this in greater detail later, but let me give you a metaphor for what dreamless sleep is like. You'll see that I do a lot of this kind of, here's a metaphor for something, which is very suitable for Tantra, and we'll be talking a lot about metaphor. So, when Kay turned 50, we went to Carlsbad Caverns, which is, if you know New Mexico, it's at the southern end of New Mexico. And in Carlsbad Caverns, they have an elevator you can go down to the bottom. And it's pretty cool. It's actually quite cold there, as a matter of fact, but I mean, it's cool also. And one of the things they do is they say, we're going to turn out the lights, because very few people have actually really seen what it's like to not be able to see anything. And I thought, oh, I guess that's true. You know, I mean, there's always some little bit of light coming in from someplace. So the ranger flips off the light switch, and you cannot believe how dark it is unless you've been in that experience. Like, okay, now, your eyes are wide open. They're functioning perfectly well. But guess what? You can't see anything, because there's nothing there to see. So deep dreamless sleep, according to Buddhists, is not a matter of unconsciousness. So this is very important. It's a matter of being conscious of nothing that transpires through the sense organs. No sense organ input. And that's why you're not aware of anything, because everything that we are familiar with is a matter of subject, a sense organ, and an object of consciousness. We'll come back to this shortly also. It's just the way we know things in our waking state of consciousness, that there's a subject and there's an object. And by the way, there's an intermediate sense organ, which we sometimes forget about, but it's always there too. Okay. Now, another category of consciousness in the nine mixings is the Buddha. And so you've heard that the Buddha has three bodies, the Dharmakaya, the Sambhogakaya, and the Nirmanakaya. You must have run across this at some point if you're sitting here in this class, be interested enough. So the Sambhogakaya is the body that exists as kind of an energy body, and it can really only be seen and experienced either in deep forms of meditation or by the saints. So because that is a little problematic from the point of view of the Buddha wanting to help other people, the Buddha takes on a physical type of form which can be seen with the ordinary sense organs, and that's called the Nirmanakaya. And then there's the essence of what the Buddha is, which is called the Dharmakaya. And in the Dharmakaya, there's total unity. So now here's the alignment. Nirmanakaya, the emanation body that you can see, is like waking consciousness, because you can see it in the waking consciousness. Sambhogakaya is like dreaming consciousness, because it's only something that happens on the mental level. And in dreaming consciousness, again, we'll come back to this in some more detail, in dreaming consciousness, your five physical sense organs aren't functioning. And even this is standard in Western thought and psychology. Only your mental consciousness or your mind is functioning. Okay. And Dharmakaya is similar to dreamless sleep. Dreamless sleep is a state of awareness of nothing, but for a Buddha, it's an awareness of total unity. Okay, so that's the alignment there. Now there's another alignment, which is the process of death and rebirth. Excuse me, I'm going to be having to drink tea all through this process because there's something in the air making my throat rough today. So similar to Dharmakaya is the moment of death. Because when you're dying, what is happening, according to the tantric teachings, is that there's a collapse of all the physical aspects of yourself into the mental aspects of yourself. And they all collapse down to a unitary consciousness without object, and it's called the clear light. In the moment of death, you experience the clear light before you go into the in-between state before you're reborn. For most people, the clear light at the moment of death passes so fast they don't even experience it because their minds aren't trained to recognize it. Why is that? Well, think about how much you recognize in deep sleep. Not very much. Okay. So in the same way, you don't really recognize the clear light at the moment of death. Clear light is analogous to dreamless sleep. Clear light is analogous to Dharmakaya. I say analogous, not the same thing. It's important to understand this. These are similar. They're metaphors. They're ways of understanding each other. They're not the same thing. So you may also know that in the Buddhist tradition, we all get reborn. And we'll talk about what that could possibly mean too, in the course of this class. And there's an in-between state before you're reborn. And in that in-between state, you are an energy being. You have an energy body and you have a consciousness or a mind, right? That's like dream. That's like Sambhogakaya. Okay. It's analogous. Okay. And then you're reborn, you get a new body, and that's like Nirmanakaya. Wah! Now you're a baby, you've got a new body, and everyone can see you again. Okay. So Nirmanakaya is like waking consciousness. So these nine are similar to each other. Now that's the fundamental Buddhist framework for the way I'll be talking about things in this class. Okay. And I'll jump back and forth between all of these things. Maybe not too much about death and rebirth, but I will be jumping back and forth between the other things. But mostly I'll be focusing on waking consciousness, dreaming consciousness. Now, there's one other important point here, which is the way I've been talking about the three ordinary states of consciousness we all experience is as if they're completely separate from each other. But in fact, the tantric teaching is that all three are going on at the same time. So why is that? How can they say this? Oh, again, thumbnail, the brief grid. The essence of the consciousness of dreamless sleep is just mere consciousness. Okay. The consciousness of waking consciousness is mere consciousness combined with the input from the five physical and the one mental sense organ. But it's just consciousness. Okay. Dream, the five physical senses have shut down, and only the mental sense is functioning. So in dream, basically what you're experiencing is ideas, memories, thoughts, everything that you're experiencing, with a few exceptions. I mean, this morning Kay was sleeping in the backyard. I walked out to sit down and have a cup of tea with her. I didn't know she was sleeping on the chaise. And she had a dream about somebody who was approaching her, and she didn't know who it was, but it was me. And when she woke up, she saw it was me. So it's not the case that when you're dreaming, everything is 100% shut down. But for the most part, things are shut down. Okay. And what you're experiencing are your own memories and the dramas that are put together by your mind for complicated reasons. Psychologists may have something to say about that or not. It depends upon their school of thought. Okay. But the important point is, from the Buddhist point of view, all three are functioning at the same time. And in fact, you know, I mean, we can experience that. If you've been practicing meditation and you know that you get in really deeply into meditation, you feel your body relaxing very, very deeply, you can actually feel the change in your awareness when you begin to almost slide into dream. It's a little bit different than the ordinary pain in the ass thoughts that are always troubling when you're trying to meditate. You really don't want to think about what's for dinner, or the guy that cuts you off when you're driving down the street that you're still pissed off about, or any of that kind of stuff. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about something different, something a bit subtler. And that's important to know, that you can mix those two together. Aha, we're coming back to the mixings again. Okay. You can bring the one into the other as part of your practice. It's not easy to do. It's probably easier to do if you're sitting in a cave in the Himalayas and you're not doing anything else but meditating, you know, and you have the time to let this happen. But you can experience it if you stick with meditation enough. Okay, so much for that. Now that's part of the grid, part of the framework of what I want to talk about. Let me shift now to the more psychological side. And when I say the psychological side, I mean the Western psychological side. And there are two names here that are relevant. One is somebody called Gregory Bateson, and the other one is someone called Edward Wittmott. I'm going to briefly talk about Bateson, and then I want to talk more detail about Wittmott. And I've picked these two people because I'm 75 now. So over the years that I have been practicing Dharma and thinking about these things, some of the writings of these two people have stuck with me consistently over the years as being very insightful. And so that's why I want to share with you some of the things that they've had to say. So they're both dead now. Bateson was English, born in the early part of the century, and trained as an anthropologist at Cambridge University. Went off to do his field work in New Guinea, where he interestingly met Margaret Mead, who might be a name that you're familiar with, depending upon the nature of your education and your age. And they got married, but he eventually emigrated to the United States. And he moved on from being strictly an anthropologist to being a cybernetic theoretician. He was involved in some of the early discussions about what became systems theory, cybernetics, and eventually came the whole computer revolution that we're familiar with. And from there, he moved on to being what you might call a family therapist. And he worked with Jay Haley. He developed family systems theory called the double bind theory. And then eventually he ended up being what you might call an ecologist. Bateson was your true Renaissance man. am very, very smart, very insightful, very interesting. I wish I'd had a chance to meet him. I never did. I worked for his daughter when we were deaning at Amherst College. And I think through her, I got very interested in Bateson. So we're going to come back to him because he has this broad view of things. Now, the other person that I want to talk about is Edward Wittmott. And Wittmott is a psychiatrist in the Jungian mode, to phrase it that way. And that's how he trained. He actually was Austrian. He escaped the Nazis in the late 1930s. I don't exactly remember what year. He was Jewish, so it was bad news to be sticking around Central Europe. Immigrated to the United States, established a practice of psychiatry in New York, became the president of the Jungian Society in New York, wrote a number of books. The one that's really stuck with me, and which my painter wife, whose tonkas you've seen, introduced me to, is something called Return of the Goddess. I won't go into a lot about why he titled it Return of the Goddess and what he has to say about goddess imagery or the archetype of the goddess. But he systematized in this book something that the Jungians have been playing with for quite a while. And it was the idea that human consciousness evolves over time. As he pointed out, you're pretty much convinced now that the human body has evolved over time. I mean, that's fairly well accepted. I mean, unless you're a conservative Christian, it's pretty well accepted, I think. I don't know, maybe conservative Muslims don't accept it either. But people who believe in science accept the idea of evolution and that human beings developed over time and that the body changed over time, the brain expanded, we developed the ability to speak over time. We weren't created with the ability to speak, even if Adam was, in that particular myth. We'll talk more about myths. The Jungians developed, and as I say, Wittmott systematized in a very neat way, an idea that human consciousness went through three phases, which are sort of distinct, but more or less overlap also. And he called them the magical, the mythic, and the rational consciousness. And in his view, most of us exist in what's called, what he calls the rational analytic consciousness. And I don't think I have to explain that too much. All of us probably have been to college. We know what the rational mind is all about. But we also know that we're not always completely rational. And maybe some of us are not rational a lot of the time. As a matter of fact, if I look around on the political scene, I see a lot of irrationality at the moment going on. And I'm going to actually make a couple comments about that. Well, the rational mind was, in this view, preceded by something called the mythic mind. The mythic mind is a mind that operated on the basis of symbols, images, stories, rituals. It was the way the mind understood things. Okay. And that was preceded way back when by something he called the magical mind. The magical mind is pretty hard to understand. It has a tribal character. He talked a lot about it from the point of view of what he called blood magic, because he did a lot of analysis of Nazi Germany, and he saw that what was happening in Germany at that time was a resurgence not just of the mythic mind, but a resurgence of the magical mind, that something was happening in relationship to those minds. So anyhow, the way the magical mind works and expresses itself is through the body, through dance, for example. The way the mythic mind expresses itself is through story, through myth, and through dream. That's why the Jungian analysts are interested in dreams and myth, because they're interested in what's going on in the mythic mind, in the so-called Western unconsciousness. Because there are things in the unconscious that are problematic. According to psychoanalytic theory, which is not real popular these days, but still, according also to the Jungians, as we grow up, we tend to split off parts of ourselves that are not liked by us, or more likely not liked by our parents. And those things get shoved into the unconscious mind. So by the time we're grown up people, we're not whole anymore. Part of us is conscious and we identify ourselves with that part. Part of us is unconscious. And for the most part, we have rejected that. Now, Jungians consider that dangerous because that which you've rejected and is unconscious, you project outwards onto others with certain degrees of hostility. And that's one of the things that gets you in trouble with other people. Okay. So if you can make those unconscious things conscious, you become more whole. It cleans up your relationships with others. It cleans up your relationship with yourself. And it gives you more life energy because you're a whole person instead of fragmented partial person. So that requires becoming familiar with what's going on in the unconscious. And that means becoming familiar with the dreaming part of yourself, the mythic part of yourself, the metaphoric part of yourself, perhaps the artistic part of yourself, perhaps the musical part of yourself. And if you want to become familiar with your magical mind, and this is where things get a little bit complicated, then you need to get familiar with your body in a whole new way, maybe through dance or maybe through martial arts or maybe through pottery. I mean, there are all kinds of different ways to get familiar with your body. Okay. It's hard to understand the magical part of the mind because it's not verbal and it's also not image using. We can talk about the mythic mind because we can talk about myths, we can talk about dreams, we can talk about symbols and images. The magical mind doesn't use any of those things. It doesn't communicate on that level. So to communicate with it becomes a little problematic. Okay, back to the grid. Okay, in my way of thinking, and this is only my way of the magical mind, excuse me, the mythic mind is like the dreaming mind. Okay, I've sort of said this in the past of doing this talk, but I want to be really specific. The mythic mind is like the dreaming mind. It's an image-using mind. And deity yoga, which we'll be talking about in greater detail, is the technique for getting in communication, or a technique for getting in communication with that part of the mind. And for working with that, I said music exists in that part of the mind and communicates with that part of the mind. We all know what it's like to be moved by music and feel things that we can't maybe rationally explain. Part of tantric practice is using sound. It's usually called mantra. Okay. Mantra communicates with and relates to and elicits that part of the mind. Just as images connect with that part of the mind, certain sounds connect with that part of the mind. Toward the end of my presentation, probably in the third class, when we look at the Vaitara Sadhana, we'll see that all the images actually start out as sounds. In the sadhana, it's always the case that what happens is a seed syllable, which is a letter in the Tibetan alphabet in this case, emerges out of, quote, emptiness. We'll talk about what emptiness means today. Seed letter emerges from emptiness and it has a sound. So in the case of the Vaitara Sadhana, a tam emerges from emptiness, and that's the sound, tam. And then the image of Vaitara emerges from that sound and from that image. And then the mantra of Vaitara emerges from that. And in practicing, all these things come together, and I'll get more specific as we go. I'm starting to paint in some of the colors here on the grid, okay? All right. So now let's do a little bit of a shift. And before we do the shift, let me stop and let's see if there are any questions. I see that there is something in the chat. So Anil, is there a question that needs to be answered?
Nothing at the moment, David.
Okay.
I should mention there is a bit of a time lag between my doing something and it showing up.
The wonders of the internet. It connects us and it disconnects us in time. It's very bizarre. I mean, I'm sitting here and I'm looking at myself. And if there was any way, I would much rather look at everybody else. And I cannot figure out how to get myself to be tiny and everybody else to be large. It's really kind of bugging me. And actually, I'm going to take a minute to see who else is here because I haven't done that. Ah, I see some of my old friends are here. And also, I guess, some new friends like Susan and Barbara. Who else is here? Linda, Deb White, Jane. Okay, well, I'm not going to go through the list. I'm glad to see there's some other people here. I've been looking at six faces up to now, and I've been wondering who else is around here. Okay, so to shift gears. For the next part of this talk, as I start filling in the colors, I'm going to first talk about waking consciousness. Then I'm going to talk about dreaming consciousness, and then I'm going to talk about dreamless sleep. So we'll do that in that sequence. And I'm not sure how far we'll get today, but we'll start with waking consciousness. And we'll start with the Buddhist teachings for waking consciousness to create some sort of context and perhaps offer some new ways of understanding things that have been important to me and perhaps could be important to you, or maybe you haven't thought about them. So, the Buddha was very practical. Shakyamuni Buddha was an immensely practical person. He didn't start sitting down with various people that came to them and offering them all kinds of highfalutin philosophies. Not like the sort of thing that I do when I'm teaching at the university. As he said, using another metaphor, if someone has shot you with a poisoned arrow, basically you don't really care too much about what that person's name is, what their parents' name are, what village did they come from, who made the bow, what was the material of the bow. There's only one thing you really care about, which is getting the bloody arrow out of yourself and cleaning up the wound. So he said, that's the way I'm teaching. You've all been pierced with the arrow of samsara, suffering, and that's what I'm going to deal with. But he didn't just stop there. He built this entire edifice on top of all that. But that's where he started with everybody. And then where he went to kind of depended upon the capacity of the different students. I, for years, have felt that, although the scholars all say, the Western scholars, pardon me, the Western scholars all say that the Mahayana teachings arose maybe 400 years or 300 years or 500 years after the Buddha. He didn't really teach that. It was all made up. I don't believe a word of that. There are public teachings and there are private teachings. They're the teachings you give to the headmaster or the head of the village, and they're the teachings that you give to the yogi who's developed intense levels of concentration. They're not the same teachings. In the 19th century, there was a great saint in Bengal called Ramakrishna. And one of his students recorded his dialogues. And it's very clear that when the village ladies would come to talk to him about spiritual life, he'd say, love God. That's all you have to do, love God. When the drunken playwright came and talked to him and said, what do I do about my spiritual life? I can't stop drinking. He said, don't worry. If you can't stop drinking, just be sure that all the plays that you write are devoted to God and write them even though you're drinking. And in time, you'll stop drinking. And in fact, that actually happened. He didn't say stop drinking. He said, this is the teaching for this particular person. To anybody else, he might have said stop drinking. To the yogi students, he gave entirely different teachings about how to practice and how to meditate that were sophisticated in a way that the housewives and the drunken playwright couldn't understand. It would have been impossible. So I've always believed the Buddha did the same thing, and that the Mahayana teachings were a little bit secret for a long time that they emerged. But the teachings that were recorded, that were well understood and set down in the Pali tradition, as the Dalai Lama likes to refer to it. He does not like to talk about Hinayana. He doesn't like to talk about even Theravada. He likes to talk about the Pali tradition. Okay. The teachings that were recorded in the Pali tradition are sometimes called Abhidharma. And in these teachings, the Buddha offers something very simple, which I've already alluded to. He says, look, for starters, you're perfectly aware of the fact that you see me. And that you see me because your eyes are open. Close your eyes, you can't see me. Okay. You've got to have sense organs. You've got to have eyes in order to see. You have to have an object that's being seen. And there has to be a consciousness that's aware of what's being seen. Those three things always come together. There is no visual consciousness without those three things coming together. In fact, if you close your eyes, although you have eyeballs, they're not working. Back to Carlsbad Caverns, right? Nothing's happening when your eyes are closed. Open your eyes, all three things come together. Same thing happens for hearing. Unfortunately, we can't close our ears. It'd be really convenient during rush hour if we could not hear anything, but it doesn't work that way. Certainly it'd be convenient where I live during rush hour if I couldn't hear anything. So it goes on through the five senses, okay? Seeing, hearing, touching, tasting, smelling, right? Those are all familiar to us. Then he goes on to the sixth sense, and this is the one that tends to throw Westerners. It always throws my students at the university. And it gets a little bit complicated. He calls it mental consciousness, right? The objects of mental consciousness are thoughts, feelings, memories, images and memory, this sort of, okay. So if mental consciousness is a consciousness of thought, what's the sense organ? Now, Westerners, of course, will jump right in and say, well, of course, it's the brain, no problem, right? That's modern psychology. In the Buddha's time, people didn't know what the brain did, or the Buddha may have known what the brain did, but ordinary people didn't know what the brain did. I don't make any assumptions about what the Buddha did, didn't know. That's way beyond me. What he said was the previous moment of consciousness is like the sense organ that mental consciousness uses to know objects. I'm not going to go down that rabbit's hole right now. We may go down that later when we talk about dreamless sleep, but not right now. But here's the important point. The important point is when we have thoughts, we think, I am thinking. According to the Abhidharma teaching revealed or brought forward from through the Abhidharma from the Buddha, I'm not quite sure the best way I want to say this. According to the Abhidharma teachings, it's not that I am thinking, it's that thoughts are occurring and there is awareness of thoughts. And in fact, according to this teaching, the way consciousness works is that all of the five sense consciousnesses are, as it were, presented to mental consciousness. And that's what our day-by-day, moment-by-moment waking experience is, okay? When I'm looking at my notes here, I'm seeing something, and my mind recognizes that this is paper with notes on it. This is the coming together of a visual image and a thought about what this is. Without the thought, it's just blank stuff without meaning. Without the thought, if you hear words, people are talking like you're listening to me. Without the thoughts of knowing what these words mean, they wouldn't mean anything. It would just be sound, okay? I mean, if I go to Paper Dosa, my favorite Indian restaurant in town, for those of you that know it, great South Asian food. If I go to Paper Dosa, and the cooks behind the counter are talking to each other in Hindi or whatever the language they may be talking to each other in. I don't even know what it is because it's one of the South Asian languages. It is meaningless to me. Why? It's because my mind doesn't attribute a specific meaning to any of those sounds. In order for those sounds to have meaning to me, my mind has to know what the sounds mean. These things have to come together. And moment by moment, that's what's going on in all of our waking experience. That's not hard to understand. But where it gets interesting is when you really think about it. In all of our waking experience, what we're experiencing is the six consciousnesses. I never actually experienced the paper that's in front of me. I experience my consciousness making a representation, a mental representation of the paper that's in front of me. I never actually experience the cars that are going by making noise during rush hour. In fact, in a certain sense, I don't experience the sound that they're making, which is energy waves in the air. What I experience is a representation, which is to me the sound of a car whose mufflers are too noisy. That's a lot of thought in there. That's also a lot of feelings that are in there. That's a lot of history that's in there. I like things that are quiet. When the guy down the street with the loud mufflers revs up his engine in the morning to go to work, it bugs me. It's not just a sound. There's something going on. And I have the image of his car with these big mufflers hanging out the back of it. And I also have the image of myself being really pissed off and thinking, come on, David, you got to live with this stuff. This is the world you're in Southside Santa Fe. Loud cars. It's just part of what's around you. Get used to it. It's like loud dogs. Get used to it. Stop letting them bug you. All these things are always coming together, all right? But here's my point. It's not the loud dogs and the loud cars. My point is the only thing we ever really experience is our own consciousness. Now, we live in this delusion that we're experiencing the world. We're not. We're experiencing our consciousness. Now, our consciousness is related to the world. I'm not talking about being a philosophical idealist. I'm not saying there's no world out there. There is a world out there. This is a long conversation that I had with one of my Tibetan lamas, who I'll talk about in a moment. There is a world out there, but we don't experience it directly. Right? We create a representation of it, and our representation is full of us. What we like, what we dislike, what we want to avoid, what we don't understand. Buddhists call these things the three poisons. Those things exist, covering over all of our experience all the time. Okay. But the main thing is that what we experience is consciousness. Now, that has some implications, some of which I'll get to later on down the line. But one of those implications is if what you're experiencing is something that you don't like, you can change that experience. Now, it's a philosophical question. If I decide I really am okay with the loud mufflers, and I'm really going to love my neighbor because he's a young guy and he probably is disempowered in this world, and the way he feels powerful is to have a real loud car, even though it's a teeny weeny little funky Honda old piece of nothing in particular, right? But I think that the reason that he has loud mufflers is it makes him feel strong, and he needs to feel strong. So I'm okay with young guys that need to feel strong. I've been there myself. I had a loud muffler. So I can change my relationship with the experience. Does that mean that his mufflers are going to change? Well, that's a very interesting question. And maybe we can come back to that. I don't know. You know, if I decide the loud dogs are okay, are they going to get quiet? They might. I don't know about that. Sometimes I've had ambiguous experiences about that. Well, they're alive and they're conscious and the mufflers aren't, so there may be some differences. Okay, here's the important point. I'm beating this horse to death, I'm afraid. All we experience is consciousness. From the point of view of practicing Tantra, practicing Vajrayana, practicing Mantrayana, practicing Buddhist Tantra. These are all synonyms. This is a very important questions at this point, because this is really critical. So I want to stop for a moment. Nothing? We're okay. We have a question from Skylar. Sure.
Hi. So I live in Colorado, and every once in a while we can go to Cave of the Winds in Colorado Springs, and they kind of do the same thing. Like you're in this cavern and they turn off the lights and you like you see nothing. But then once the lights are off for a long time, it's almost like you start to see something. Is that the experience of the prior state of mind, like you were kind of touching upon?
Well, it depends upon what you mean when you see something. I mean, my experience in Carlsbad was I started seeing little flashing lights, which is to say it was the noise that was created in my eyeballs and nothing else was going on. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, because it was like, and some people said that they started to see like the brief outline of the room and like what they thought was there.
Yeah. Well, like, I think you've answered your own question.
Okay.
What they thought was there.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, yeah, the host would kind of move and she's like, you know, you thought I was here, but then she moved and yes. Okay. Thank you.
It's quite an experience, isn't it? It's quite interesting. Any more questions at this point before I move on? Stephen, was that a question?
Yeah, David, thank you very much for taking my question and giving us this teaching. I guess I want to relate this to a course I'm sort of in the middle of right now called Awareness and Knowers that's being offered at the center as well. So when you're talking about experiencing a representation of the object, we're talking about the conceptual idea of an object.
Right.
Might have had sensory input, but then it pretty quickly becomes, I liked how you said that, it actually becomes something that's really full of us. So I wanted to check with you, that's it then, like in technical terms, it's a meaning generality or a sound generality that we're talking about here.
Yeah, you're getting into pramana, and I'm not going to go down that line in a basic introductory talk, but absolutely, yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, a meaning generality is what we're experiencing.
A mental image.
Mental image is, in my own translation of Nagarjuna, that was the word that I used.
Yeah.
I thought that was a little clearer, mental image.
So we've just left all of our senses behind. And so we're in the conceptual realm, mostly behind. I mean, we're getting constantly updated sense data, but our senses are pretty much taking a back seat.
Right. Yeah. And, you know, if you were a Zen practitioner, for example, one of the things you would really be trying to do would be to step out of the meaning generality, to step out of the mental image, to encounter the direct sensory experience. I mean, this is one of the things that Zen practitioners do attempt to do. If you ask anybody who spend intensive time doing Zazen, they'll tell you, wow, that is hard. And if it's happened, it comes in fleeting little, it was there for a moment and then it was gone. Although not necessarily. Kay told me about a several days long experience she had along those lines, but then again, she didn't know what to do with it. She thought she was maybe a little bit nuts or wasn't sure where to go with it. It was a profound experience, but it was like, okay, what do we do here? And sometimes when I talk to my philosophy students about this, I'll say, you know, it sounds great. And I'm sure if I've experienced it, I don't recall. Sounds great, but you know what? If you had to get into the rush hour commute in the morning and that was all you experienced, you wouldn't make it to work. You know, I mean, we think, wow, if I could just get rid of this mind that's making all this racket and all this trouble for me, everything would be great, but actually we need it. It's useful. It's not like we really, it'd be nice if there was a switch, you know, you can go okay, turn it off, turn it back on again. Maybe they'll, we'll get there sometime. Who knows? I'm not sure if it's a good thing if we're going to get there, but I, you know, who knows about the future?
Yeah. And that's interesting. You bring up the Zen tradition. And I guess at least at the sutra level of this tradition, the idea is that you work on your conceptual understanding until it becomes so familiar it falls away, which hopefully I haven't had any kind of direct experience like that, but you work on the mental image until it falls away, and then you end up at the same place the Zen practitioner who's breaking his head with a koan or her head with a koan, and or just sitting staring at the wall for days on end.
Well, thank you for that segue, because that brings me to the next thing that I want to talk about.
All right. Well, if I may, David, I'll just leave you with, I guess it's kind of a joke. So as we study this promenade, we talk about direct perception and inferential cognition, but then we get to dreams. And it gets really confusing for the class, because I think at that level with the Abhidharma, there really is no words or terminology or categorization of dreams, at least at the level I've been exposed to it. It's just either conceptual or direct. And we just get really confused about, like, what is a dream a valid cognition?
You don't really want me to go down that rabbit.
No, maybe not. I'll just let you segue. Thank you very much, David, for answering my question.
Yeah, so my segue, though, is a partial answer to your question, which is deity yoga is the language for dealing with that level of consciousness. But of course, there's no deity yoga in Pramana, is there? Right. And it's not like the great, you know, it's not like Dharmakirti didn't know about Tantra, but it's not in Pramana. Okay, so we'll just sort of leave it at that. Okay. Okay, Madhyamaka. Switching gears once again. So the way I started out in Buddhism, actually, I started out as a Zen meditator in 1967 with a Vietnamese Zen monk who was teaching a course on Buddhism at UCLA, where I was a student. And I'd been reading Alan Watts and other early teachers, D.T. Suzuki and that sort of thing. And then here the real article shows up. This is a Vietnamese Zen monk who had to leave Vietnam in 1966, or they would have put a bullet in his head. He decided to come to the United States, he said. And he was teaching Buddhism at UCLA. So I've had a foot in the Zen world. But when I was interested in becoming more scholarly about Buddhism, which I could do because I was working as a counseling psychologist, I had a livelihood. I could do something dumb like get a PhD in Asian studies. I was much more interested at that point in Tibetan Buddhism. I won't go into why that is. But I'd read a book called The Key to the Middle Way by the Dalai Lama. It was one of the early books. It turned out that The Key to the Middle Way had a chapter from Chandrakirti's Prasanapada, Clear Words, one of the commentaries on Nagarjuna. And I didn't understand anything. I literally did not understand a single thing in this book. It was a complete mystery to me. Therefore, I decided that's what I was going to study, because I didn't understand anything, right? Which was, I don't know if that was a good move or not, but that led me into translating Nagarjuna's 70 stanzas on emptiness for my doctoral dissertation. And then moving farther into directly meeting with some of the really fine teachers at the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives, early 80s. And I had the good fortune to study with Geshe Sonam Rinchen at the Library of Tibetan Works and Archives. And he became my true Madhyamaka teacher. We retranslated everything in the 70 stanzas, and it eventually got published as a book with his commentary on it. So in the process, I learned a lot about Nagarjuna, who is sort of fundamental for understanding Mahayana Buddhism, inescapable, have to go there at some level. But I also learned that all of his complicated arguments were not actually essential for understanding the points of Madhyamaka if you wanted to meditate. Now, Steve asked a question about meeting generalities about mental images and about thoughts. And he said, so, okay, so you get to the point where you understand your thoughts completely and you can set them aside. But there's another side to understanding how the thoughts work. And Nagarjuna brings this out, which is, yeah, you want to be free of your thoughts, but you can also use your thoughts effectively to bore down into other levels of consciousness. And that was the part of Madhyamaka that really got my interest. Okay. And I came across a teaching that really stuck with me that basically boiled down to all of Madhyamaka into sort of three things that you need to know. And if you know those three things and you meditate on those three things, once you begin to understand them intellectually, you can make a whole lot of progress in understanding the Buddha Dharma and in understanding yourself. So let me share those three things with you. And they're teachings about the true nature of what we experience and of what exists. Now remember, I've just done this whole riff on what we really experience is only our consciousness of things, not the things themselves. But we'll simplify these things from this point of view, and we'll talk about the things themselves, because it's actually true of them as well as our representation of them, which is that everything depends on something else. Everything depends on causes and conditions. Nothing exists on its own. Everything is made up or compounded of parts and particles. That's another thing. We experience things as if they're whole, but they're always made up of parts and particles. So for example, this piece of paper strikes me as just a piece of paper. That's the way I naturally relate to it. But really it's made up of all kinds of little bits of wood fiber, if you really get right down to it. And by the way, there's some writing on it, which means there's some ink on it, which means there's a lot of little black dots there, okay? Well, I don't experience a lot of little black dots. I just experience letters and words and ideas and sounds. And I don't experience wood fibers. I just experience a piece of paper. But that's not what's truly there. It's there in my mind because I like to see whole things. It's there in my mind that this is a word because I like to see words instead of dots of black. But is a word really there, or is dots of black there? Well, they're both there, actually. It's not just one or the other. The other thing is, Thich Nhat Hanh says, this used to be a tree, right? And it existed as a tree because it got rained on and because there was sunlight and so on and so forth. And then somebody came along, chopped down the tree, send it to a mill, ground it up, turned it into paper, added a bunch of stuff to it, got put on a truck, shipped to, I don't know, Amazon. I got on the computer, I sent a message to Amazon, Amazon put it on another truck, sent it to me. I put it in my printer, and now here it is. All those causes and conditions had to come together for this piece of paper to be here. I don't see any of that when I look at this piece of paper, but I can. If I want to, if I do that little mental riff on causes and conditions, I can see, as Thich Nhat Hanh says, I can see the cloud in the paper in my mind. And I can see how everything connects in my mind. But that is the reality out there. It's also the reality of what's going on in my mind. And I can see all the bits. And that brings us to the third thing. The things exist in the way we experience them through the designation of our own mind. My mind looks at this and the thought paper occurs. This is the meaning generality. This is the mental image, paper. And I never experience anything without it. No matter what it is, my mind always plunk puts the concept on the experience. And that's the way I experience everything. Okay. Now we can say that that's bad. And sometimes maybe it is bad because it's incorrect. I mean, it seems pretty apparent to me that the entire eco-catastrophe of climate change and everything else that we're experiencing completely depends upon the fact that our capitalist industrialist and socialist industrialist civilization completely ignored the fact of how everything connects to everything else. And where is everything going? Where did everything come from? How does it fit together? And what's really going on? It's based upon total illusions that we can create all of this stuff. And then the garbage truck is going to pick it up and dump it someplace and I can forget about it. Well, we know that's bullcrap. It's not true. But that's the way we've been living for years. And that's the way we were programmed to live for years. And why? Because of the three poisons: greed or desire, hatred, and delusion, which obscure the reality of the fact that everything depends on causes and conditions. Everything is made up of parts, and everything only appears to be the way it is because of designation by mind. So those are three great themes to meditate on. Nagarjuna didn't just put that stuff out there because he wanted to be clever. When I started studying Nagarjuna, which was in the mid-70s, most of the people who were writing about him said, well, he's a logician, he's a philosopher, that's what he's about. No, he's a great yogi, right?
Observer.
Huh, Rowena?
He's an observer.
Well, he is an observer, but he's also a great yogi because he's given us these ways of looking at things so we can transform our minds and see the truth of what's going on. In that sense, we can be true observers. Right. Okay. So from my point of view, that's kind of all you need to know about Madhyamaka, those three things, providing you sit down and meditate on those three things for 10 or 15 or 20 years, so that they start making organic sense. So you start seeing the cloud in the paper. Then you're really getting at Madhyamaka. If you're just thinking the thoughts, that's nice, but that's not really the point. You get at having the direct experience. Okay, so those are the two aspects of waking consciousness that I want to talk about from the Buddhist perspective. Madhyamaka, Abhidharma, and those simple ideas. And that's the foundation, because everything in Tantra is built on those kinds of foundations. There are other things too, Bodhisattva vow, Bodhicitta, so on and so forth. I'm going to set all that stuff aside for the moment. We'll come back to it. Now, there's one other thing before we close the door on this, and that's I, me. Remember I said whenever we're thinking of something, we have the thought, I am thinking this. I'm feeling this. I'm the one that's pissed off by the loud mufflers. I'm the one that's experiencing these feelings. Okay, the Buddhist teaching is, where is this I? I think we've all heard this in the past. Okay. So I'm going to foreshorten it. Where this I is not a little person that's sitting inside of you. We used to call that a homunculus. There's no little homunculus inside of David that's sort of running the show. Maybe like in The Wizard of Oz, remember? The wizard was behind a curtain and he had all those levers, right? And all the smoke was going up and, you know, the big image was in the big head was on the screen, scaring Dorothy and Toto and everybody. And then Toto pulled the screen back, pulled the curtain back. There was just this snake oil salesman from Kansas who was doing all this stuff. Well, there's no snake oil salesman inside of us. Well, I don't know, maybe there is inside of some people. I can think of a few people. I won't mention any names. You can imagine who I'm thinking of. But there is there's a sense, there's a felt sense of I, and there's an idea. And that idea, I, that idea of David, is all there is. And it's designated on the body, and it's designated on the mind. And if you really work with it, you can see how that's true. And if you really think about it, you can see how it's true. I mean, here's something that's really obvious. I have pictures of myself with my various teachers on the bookcase up here. Here's David with the Dalai Lama. He's 55 years old. Here's David with Geshe Sonam Rinchen. He's 35 years old. Here's David with one of my other teachers. He's 25 years old. I keep seeing David with all those people. And let me tell you, 25-year-old David and 75-year-old David don't really have a lot in common with each other. Our bodies are certainly not the same. For one thing, there was a lot more going on up here. And a few other things were quite different as well. And yet I keep saying it's all David. I didn't even relate to the world in the same way. I didn't talk the same way. I didn't think the same way. As I said, I certainly didn't look the same way. And yet it's David. No. The idea of David has been hanging around for 75 years, even though David's been changing all those 75 years. We all know this. We've all had that experience. The idea of David is designated on this body-mind as time goes on. Well, so here's an interesting idea. What if you choose to designate the idea, me, David, Kayla, Anil, on something else? I mean, if it can be designated on this body-mind and designated on a different body-mind 25 years ago, and it's just a process of designation, what if you could get in control of the process of designation? What might happen? Okay. When we start talking about the actual practice of Tantra, we're going to find that in doing the tantric sadhanas, and a sadhana is a term for a mental ritual that we go through, that there are two things that are critical. One is called divine pride, and the other is called clear appearance. Because what do? Well, I practice white Tara. So I sit down in the morning, and I develop a mental image of white Tara. And I try and make that mental image as clear as possible, which for me is not real clear. I'm sure if my wife did, it would be really clear, because she's a great artist. She can see that way. But I get sort of a sense of it. And then the other thing I do, which is really important, is I designate I onto white Tara. Because what's really important is that I start in every way experiencing me as white Tara. Now, why would I want to experience me as white Tara? Now, I'm going to get ahead of myself here. Suppose I am the crusty old intellectual. Well, suppose I am the crusty young intellectual that I used to be, right? With kind of locked up feelings and not a lot of empathy or sympathy for other people. Why would I be that way? You know, children aren't naturally born without empathy. They're not naturally born without sympathy for others. You look at young children, they feel and they care about others, it's perfectly clear. They have to learn not to. It has to be knocked out of them. It has to be repressed. It has to be cut off. And I grew up in an environment that was really good at cutting me off from my native feelings, cutting me off from my native sympathy for other people, cutting me off from my empathy for other people, and shoving all that capacity down into my unconscious. And why? Well, because, jiminy, in the 1950s, boys weren't supposed to feel that kind of stuff. They were supposed to be tough. They were supposed to get out on the playground and beat each other up. They weren't supposed to get out on the playground and think and feel, oh, how are you feeling today? Isn't it a nice day? Oh, it looks like you're hurting. Did you break your arm? What happened? You know, oh, that's terrible. I mean, even the way I'm mimicking it, right? It's like, no, you weren't supposed to feel that stuff. So you repressed it, you cut it off, okay? Well, what does that mean? It means you're not a whole person. It means you left some of yourself behind. And guess what? If you want to survive in this world, they always used to say you better be tough and be able to beat people up. Well, guess what? Those guys in the 1950s had it all wrong. If you want to survive in this world, you better be in good, wholesome, harmonious relationships with other people. Now, maybe you need to have a crusty skin, but that doesn't mean you don't need to be in relationship with other people and be whole and bring all that stuff back, right? So these images, the deities, are parts of the perfected Buddha. The perfect Buddha, Shakyamuni, had all this stuff, right? The deities that we work with in Tantra, right, are parts of the Buddha. This is the compassion aspect of the Buddha. We call it Avalokiteshvara. This is the wisdom aspect of the Buddha. We call it Manjushri. This is the fierce aspect of the Buddha. It's kind of saying, wake up, get your act together. We call that Vajrapani, okay? The Buddha had all that stuff going on in him. And every human being can have all that stuff going on in them if they surface it, if they make it conscious. And we're going to be talking a whole lot more about that. And I see it from the time, we don't have a lot of time left. So that is in the language of being a professional teacher. We call that forecasting what's coming up next, or that's the trailer for what's coming up. But again, to summarize, the main point is we can take the eye and we can designate it on any part of ourselves. And to look at this from a psychological, Western psychological point of view, if you've repressed some part of yourself and you symbolize it or you create an image of it and you designate I on it, you recreate your being it, even though you repressed it in the past. So David may have pushed his empathetic self out of himself in the past, but these days, David is bringing that back little by little, by remembering that he, David, is that sympathetic white Tara, I am that. And I am becoming whole again by doing that. Okay. So that's part of where we're going next week. Okay. So I can't believe I've been talking for an hour and 22 minutes. I almost never do anything like that. Are there questions at this point? If there's not, I have a closing dedication. Steve, yes. For Stephen, I'm sorry.
It doesn't really matter. It's just a label. Thank you very much for taking my question, David. Now, you said a little bit earlier, there's really two critical parts to deity yoga.
Right.
One was divine pride.
Right.
And pride can, I guess, be positive or negative. So I guess here the pride is based on the positive qualities of that deity,
yeah.
The actual genuine and, well, I guess genuine and helpful qualities of the deity, not based on its power to destroy or control or whatever. Am I right there?
Well, okay. Divine pride is the way the term has been translated by just about all the Western translators. And unfortunately, pride has a lot of connotations, and they're mostly bad connotations for us, you know, like you're not supposed to be proud. Well, most of us have been taught we're not supposed to be proud anyway. So don't take that word pride too far. What's more important is profound identification of the I as the deity image, and the deity sound, by the way, and the deity feelings, by the way, even the deity smell, I suppose, by the way, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Okay. So that's what's critical. Yeah.
And the second part of the tantric sadhana, the critical elements, you said, I think it was clear appearance.
Correct.
So there, what you're saying is, you have a mental image, but it's non-conceptual. Is that what that means?
No, it is conceptual. It starts out conceptual.
Right.
I'm going to get ahead of myself a little bit, but you start out by trying to imagine what it would be like to be white Tara. So for example, white Tara has seven eyes. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And if I could bring my feet up, 6 and 7. She has eyes in her feet. She has eyes in her hands and 3 in her head. So she's non-ordinary looking. And that's actually important. I'm not going to get into why that's important right now. But developing a clear image of my right hand is on my right. I don't know how to do this. My right, here we go. I got a better idea. Here we go. White Tara. Right hand, I know it's probably reversed in your image. Right hand has an eye in it. It's really important that you imagine yourself sitting there with your right hand on your right knee with an eyeball in your hand. Okay. Is that a conceptual image? It is in the beginning. But you want to get to the place where you feel the eyeball in your hand. That's not exactly conceptual anymore, right? So you start in one place and you work to another place.
Yeah, and I guess, yeah, and what you're really doing here is you're actually reversing causality. So you're starting at the end point or the result and taking that as the cause.
Yeah, you are. Say,
but, yeah.
And in fact, there is a teaching, sort of a systematic teaching of what are called cause vehicles and effect vehicles. And in the Vajrayana, it said that sutra is a cause vehicle. You're accumulating the causes of liberation. You're accumulating the causes of enlightenment. But in Vajrayana, you're practicing an effect vehicle. And you start with the fact that you are potentially enlightened. That's the effect. Being enlightened. And you work with that back, as you said, to the current situation you're in. You use it. In fact, well, this is a Nyingma teaching, but there's a way of understanding what's called the Tathagata Garbha or the Sugata Garbha, which is the Buddha nature which is already within you. And so the practice is about manifesting what's already within you. Then there's this big conflict between these schools of thought about, is it potentially within you or is it actually within you? What does this mean? And so on and so forth. And we could bounce that around like we were playing tennis, but it's now 4:28. And I don't want to bounce it around anyway. Okay, so look, let me close with this dedication, even though it's going to take us a little bit beyond time, but I would like to. And even though this is 9/11, I'm not going to talk about this being 9/11, except to say this is 9/11. This is something that my wife, this is a dedication or a prayer that my wife does on a regular basis. It's beautiful. I pray for all the sentient beings who have lost their lives to the wildfires and COVID. To all sentient beings who have lost home and shelter, may our prayers reach all who are standing on the front lines, the firefighters, the nurses, the doctors, the caretakers, the pilots flying into the flames dropping retardant, to the ground support crews, to the volunteers who rally to offer help in a myriad of helpful activities. May our prayers help quickly turn the tide of this destruction. Soha, may it be so. Uh-huh. And I'll see you next week, I hope.
Thank you.